July 28th, 1985. I'm Mark Wagler, talking with Halsey Reinhardt at his home in Rockbridge, Wisconsin. This is tape one, side one. And with us today is his daughter, Kate. And what's your last name?
Katie Reinhardt.
Katie Reinhardt? You're using your name, Katie Reinhardt. This is tape one, side one. Were you going to start off with the story of Herb?
Oh, well, the story of Herb. This story of Herb is really Ed Tubbs' story. And I wish you could have record Ed Tubbs, and he lives down by Twin Bluffs, down by Sexonville. But he's telling about this famous coonhound, Herb, and he said everybody had said throughout the community that a community in which everybody had a coonhound, that there was no coonhound excelled old Herb. And so Ed said, one day I just thought I would go over and see my neighbor John, who owned Herb, and just see. We take Herb out and see how Herb really did his job in cunning coon. Said we went over, and old Herb came rather laconically around from the back of the house, and he was a miserable looking old hound. He looked more like a dirty rug than anything else, and his ears were hanging down, but he had that intelligent, professional move of one who knew all there was to know about his particular field. And John said, well, we'll just load Herb in the back of the pickup, and we'll take him out, and we'll let him stand up in the back, and we'll drive out on some of the country roads, and whenever there's a coon anywhere in this vicinity, Herb will let us know. So John and Ed Tubbs rode out through the Tennessee countryside, and after a while, old Herb gave a couple rather tentative little barks, and John said, well, Herb has the scent. He feels that there's a coon here. And so they stopped the pickup alongside of the road and let old Herb out. Well, Herb looked north and he looked south and he looked east and he looked west. And then he put his nose down on the ground and snuffed like a vacuum cleaner about twice around the pickup. And all at once he stopped and he looked and his ears came up and then he took right off up through the woods, just barking his head off. And Herb was really having a beautiful time following that coon trail. And if you've never experienced being out coon hunting and experienced the beauty of a coon on the trail, you just can't imagine what it was like to be out there in the moonlight with the stars shining and the shadow of the trees, and you're trying to look into the shadows to see where Herb might be, but his voice was coming loud and clear. All at once there's a dead silence, absolute dead silence, and you have to have experience being out in the hillsides in the moonlight to know how silent it can be, because the other night sounds come crowding in and crowd out the sound that you're listening for, but Herb didn't make a sound. After a little while, Ed said, John, I really believe that Herb missed the trail. And he said, no, Ed, he's crossing posted land. And in a little while, Herb had crossed the posted land and had taken off over the hill again. And a little while, his voice changed, and the barks came a little more staccato. And John said, well, Herb has one up a tree. We better get around there. So they drove the pickup around through the woods and up a little side road and walked out into an open clearing, and there stood an old dead elm tree out in the middle of the clearing, and here down on the ground stood old Herb looking up into that tree and just barking to his heart's content and his tail going up and down, and through all the antics of really being sold on the idea that there's a coon up the tree. So Ed said, we walked around the tree, and I said, John, there's no coon up that tree. And he said, I think Herb was just making a mistake. And John said, no, just be patient. Herb's running a little ahead of schedule tonight. The coon hasn't got there yet. Another coonhound story that we used to pick up at the store when we were running store was about the coal trailers. Now, if you know, any old cow dog will kill a coon if it comes walking through the barnyard. But it takes a real expert coonhound to pick up a trail that is hours old and follow it through the woods and follow it through the woods until the trail gets warmer and fresher, and eventually he trees that coon. And these two fellows were talking about their coon hounds and what great coal trailers they were. And one of them said, well, let's take your coon hound out, and we'll give him a chance, and then we'll take my dog out and try him, and see, we'll decide which of these dogs is the best coal trailer. So they took one of them out in the back of the pickup, and they let him out. He snuffed around on the ground a while, and finally he rather reluctantly took a trail up through the woods, and the farther he went, the more energetic his baying became, and all at once he started to bark. And he said, well, there he has one up a tree. So they went up, and here's an old tree with a knot hole on the side of it, way up on the side where a coon might be in. The dog is sitting on the ground with his tail going up and down and barking. He's really barking treed. And there was no way of getting the coon out, and so one farmer said to the other, well, let's just go back to the pickup and get the saw and saw the tree down, and that way we'll get the coon. So they were equipped for this sort of thing, and they went and got the axe and the saw, and they sawed the tree down, and it split wide open, and there was the skeleton of an old coon who had been dead for months, nothing left but just a pinch of hair and the bones. The farmer that owned the dog said, well, he certainly did a good job, and the other one was totally mystified, and he said, well, that amazes me that he would be able to trail of that coon that's been so dead for so long in that hollow tree that there's nothing left but his skeleton. But he said, I don't want to give up. I want to try my dog out. I really want to show you how my dog will do. So the next night they took the second farmer's dog out, and they took him out to the hillside, and they turned him loose. Well, it took him a little while to find a coal trail, but eventually, why, going around through the woods with his nose on the ground like a vacuum cleaner, he picked up the scent, and he started going off up across the field. And he got about halfway up across this field, and all at once he stopped, just recoiled, and he sniffed to the left, and he sniffed to the right, and he sniffed down, and he sniffed up. And then he backed up about 2 feet and jumped about 4 feet high, came down on the ground and picked up the trail again and took right off up over the hill. Well, they went up here and they found the old elm, and here was he was barking treed, and they cut it down, and there was a dead coon in the tree. And it probably hadn't been dead as long as the other coon, but it was there was certainly the remains of a coon there. And he said, well, apparently your dog is as good as my dog, but he said, I'd like to know what that jumping bit was out there in the middle of the field. And he said, well, as close as I figured out, when the coon went up through here, there had been a fence across the field. Have you heard that one, Mark? our pastor liked to was a hunter, and he liked to have a retriever. Boy, I gotta have a second to put this one in line.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Our pastor was a duck hunter, and he always wanted a retriever. Just one of those beautiful dogs that will just go right up, swim right out into the lake and pick up the duck that had been down and bring him back. And the church was very beneficent. They gave a special collection one day, and they passed along about an extra $400 to the pastor as a Christmas present. Christmas don't fit in here. His wife had decided that they might like to apply that on a new organ, but the minister had all made up his mind ahead of time that he was going to have a golden retriever. So he sent to Boston, and in a few days, on the express came this crate, and in it was this beautiful golden retriever. Well, he could hardly wait till the Sunday service was over. It came late Saturday afternoon to take his retriever out and see how the retriever would perform. And he went out to a little lake where there was nobody around to watch him, and with his shotgun, and he waited a little while, and pretty soon a covey of ducks flew in, and he pulled up and shot, and one duck fell splash into the water 150 feet offshore. He turned his retriever loose. The retriever went down to the shore. He just stopped a minute and looked to make sure where that duck was, and just walked right out on the water. Walked right out where the duck was and reached down and picked him up and walked in carrying the duck and dropped him down. Well, he was so amazed, but he patted the dog on the hand or on the head, and he thought, I just really didn't see this. And so he waited a little while, and another bunch of ducks came through, and he dropped a duck, and the new retriever, golden retriever, just walked down to the shore and walked right out on the water, picked up the duck and laid him down. He couldn't believe it, but he wanted to, he just had somebody else to witness it, and he decided he'd better go into the into town and get his friend Jim Olson, who was the editor of the paper, and take him out and have him see witnesses. So he got Jim out there, and they sat there a while and waited, and pretty soon a duck came through, and he downed the duck, and the duck fell in the water, and he patted the retriever and said, get him, and the retriever ran out. He just walked right back on the water and carried the duck back and laid it down at the pastor's feet. And he said to Jim, now, did you see that? Jim said, how much did you give for that dog? And he said, I paid almost $500 for that dog. He said, boy, you got beat. He said, you know, that dog can't swim.
That's wonderful. Yeah, you had some good spot stories.
Yeah, well, whole spot.
We always had spot, didn't we?
Yes, we always had spot. Oh, I think so. I think we always had spot. Spot grew up with us. And we got him as a pup. And as the girls grew up, they thought his whole name was Get Away Spot, because Spot was always there and climbing up on you and sniffing. And he always stayed on the little outside porch. And one of the hired men always declared that that was Spot's office. And Spot was very seldom away from his office if the rest of the people were at home. But Spot was the laziest cow dog. He was absolutely the laziest cow dog you have ever heard. He reluctantly would go get the cattle. And I had found out after training Spot that the only way to get him to go was to just take him down just take him by the collar and just slap him up good and say, now, Spot, darn you, go get those cows. And he would rather reluctantly trundle out.
See him with his tail between his legs.
So, with the expression on his face that said, somebody just hit me.
Dragging along the ground.
Yeah, but you'd say, Spot, dang it, get out there. Keep going, Spot, get those cows. Well, eventually, I bought a Jeep. The Jeep was Spot's second home. He just lived in the Jeep. And in fact, one of the girls wrote an essay in Spanish in school. It was called The Home of the Dog. Remember the essay that Carol wrote? Spot lived in the Jeep. And Spot found out that if I would take him out and put him out to go get the cows, if he was a little reluctant, I'd take him a little farther. So it got so that I would take Spot out about a third of the way to where the cattle were, and I'd get out and I'd slap Spot up and give him a kick in the rear, and he would reluctantly go and get the cows. And then it got so a little bit later that Spot wouldn't get out and go get the cows unless I took him halfway to where the cows were. Well, then it got to the point after a while where I was two-thirds of the way, just almost to the cattle. And I'd have to put old Spot out on the ground and go through the ritual, get out and slap his ears and say, Spot, dang it, go get those cows. And Spot would be reluctantly going. I'd say, now you keep going, Spot. And I would perhaps use a little profanity on him. And Spot would go and get the cows. And, you know, the ultimate conclusion of this was that one day Spot took the Jeep back and I had to take the cows. and another time Spot was so trigger happy when it came to chasing squirrels. Spot was really trigger happy, and I'm not sure whether it was Katie or Carol and I were driving out to the woods, and we laid the Jeep down, or the windshield down on the Jeep, so it was perfectly flat. Spot always sat between us. That was his favorite spot. Spot's favorite spot, no pun intended. And Spot was sitting there, his favorite spot, and all at once a squirrel jumped out of a tree right ahead of us. Spot took off right out all over the flat top of the Jeep, disregarding the fact entirely that he was up in the Jeep and not down on the ground. And when he came to the edge of the radiator, he just simply fell off in front of the pickup. And we stopped, and Spot got up and shook his head, and he looked so foolish sitting there in the road, wondering where the squirrel had gone. We had a lot of fun with Spot. I told the story at Carol's wedding, how Carol and Spot and I used to ride through the woods, and Spot would talk all the time. He carried on a conversation with you. And so one of us would be the straight man and interpret what Spot was saying, and the other one would give the answers to his questions. So we had a lot of fun with Spot. I was thinking one of the things that happened to me when I was farming that was sort of an interesting little antidote. I was never much of a hunter, and I didn't like to kill things particularly, but sometimes the hunting instinct is pretty high in your metal makeup, and I was plowing corn, and there was this whole ringneck pheasant, and he ran along the edge of the cornfield, and every time I come down, he would run back and forth, and each time I plowed, I got two rows closer to him, and I kept thinking, now, if that old boy just stays over there, I'm not going to go after him, because if I did, he'd fly, but I'll just wait and see how close I can get to him, and I got within about four rows of that ringneck pheasant, and he just stood there and looked at me. I thought, boy, if I just had something, and I reached into the toolbox, and I picked up the hammer, and I threw the hammer, and conk, I hit that pheasant, and just knocked him flat. We were right alongside of the river, and the pheasant just gave about three big flops, and flopped over backwards, flopped right into the river, and I thought, well, boy, oh boy, I've gone this far with this thing, and I sure want that pheasant. So I just jumped right into the river after him. Well, the cold water revived the pheasant, and he took off and left me sitting in the river.
Such a hunter.
such a hunter as I was.
Now, are you going to say that's really a true story?
Yes, that is a true story. Yeah, and that's the extent of my hunting ability, probably. I might tell you a story that happened to my Uncle Dewey and I in the farming process. It was always our job to do the home butchering. And as much as I hate killing things, it always was my duty to shoot the pig or shoot the steer that we were going to butcher. And as much as I dislike killing, I would do it as humanely as possible. And I guess it's one of the things that you have to face in life, that life does have death for purposes sometimes. Anyway, my Uncle Dewey and I were going to butcher a yearling Holstein bull. And he had horns about, each horn was probably 8 or 10 inches long. And we decided we would do this scientifically. We put him in the first stanchion, just inside of the barn, by the barn door. And then we dropped the fork down from the hay mall that we always pulled the fork loads of hay up, and took the fork off and put a log chain on it. Then we took the Jeep out and started it and put it on the end of the hay rope. Theoretically, we were going to shoot the bull. The bull was going to fall backwards and fall down. Dewey was going to hook the chain on the leg. I was going to run out and get in the Jeep. We were going to, that would give us enough horsepower to drag the Jeep out the closed barn door, swinging him up off the ground. Then we'd cut his throat and he would bleed out, and then we'd proceed with our butchering. Well, the best laid plans of mice and men, off gang of glee. And the best laid plans of life and men, the best laid plans of mice and men, off gang of glee. And in following through our routine, I shot the bull, but instead of the bull falling backwards, the bull lunged forward. And he dropped down inside of the uprights of two wooden stanchions, and there he laid on the floor, kicking. And Dewey grabbed one horn, and I grabbed the other, and we tried to raise him high enough to lift him out of the V of the stanchion. And we moaned and we groaned and we couldn't get him up. And we had such a terrible time. And finally Dewey said, we've got to get him out of here. We've got to get him swung up. We've got to get his throat cut so that he will bleed adequately in order to butcher so the meat will be good. He said, get the axe, get the axe. So we got the axe and we chopped off the wooden stanchion. And then we lifted the head up and we pulled it through. And we were just in the process of pulling the bull up. And Dewey said to me, did it ever occur to you to cut his head off?
You know, there are some other stories. I think the Carol stories are part of this whole thing. It seems like once it was one of Carol's calves that fell off the rock, and we had to butcher it, and so we had to spend a whole year pretending that it was something else we were eating.
Oh,
what
yeah.
What is that? I've forgotten how that
works. Well, every one of the girls, of course, always had an animal that they claimed, and this was a beautiful Holstein heifer calf that we intended to raise, and that would be Carol's cow. When it grew up, that would be Carol's cow. And where we lived at the farm, right as a part of the barnyard fence, was a high 60-foot, well, perhaps not 60 always, but at least 30 to 60-foot cliff. And this calf wandered around some way or other and got on top of the cliff and fell down into the barnyard and broke its back and wasn't able to get up. So there was nothing to do but to salvage it by butchering it. And Carol went crying to the house that you aren't going to butcher my calf, you aren't going to butcher my calf. No way. But we did have to butcher the calf. And the meat was put in the locker, and whenever we would go to the locker and get some of that particular beef, why, we would have to camouflage it as veal or lamb or something of that kind.
And then there's also the story, remember the baby elephant story?
Oh, that was
the wonderful story with Carol.
Well, yes, one of our hired men, Dick Bell, was always telling stories and pulling little jokes, and a rather humorous sort of a old man. And Carol was so afraid of mice. But we were hauling hay one day, and we opened up the haystack, and here was a nest of little baby hairless mice, and they looked like little elephants is what they really looked like. They were just like little miniature smooth-skinned elephants, and they were only about an inch and a half long. And Dick said, Carol, just look at that baby elephant. Now, if you would take that home, put it in your handkerchief, put it in your pocket, and carry it home with you and feed it, you could raise yourself an elephant. And Carol really took this hook, line, and sinker. She was so careful, and she put the baby mouse in her pocket. And after she got it very well in her pocket and was nurturing was very careful not to press on the pocket with that baby mouse in there, Dick said to me, also, did you really think that was a baby elephant? It just looked like a little bit like a baby mouse. At which time she almost shed everything she had to get rid of the baby elephant. So I always talked about Carol raising the baby elephant.
There's another Carol story. Remember when Mother got called to the school because Carol had fainted, and one of the kids met her at the door and said Carol Reinhart died?
Yes, the girls would help me throw down silage sometimes before they went to school,
and or after school when it was almost dark.
Or after school when it was almost dark, because we were without a hired man and lots of work to do, and without any boys, so the girls had to improvise what boys might do.
She was brave. She would climb up. I wouldn't climb up in that silo.
Well, this particular morning, Carol climbed up almost to the top of the silo, up the inside of the chute, and shoveled out her a bunch of silage, and then tossed the fork down. The fork went halfway down and caught on the side and lodged across the chute. And then she had to climb down and hang on the rungs of the ladder inside of the chute and lift the fork out of the rungs of the ladder and drop the fork on down, which she did very successfully. However, when she got to school in about an hour later, thinking about it, she just suddenly fainted, passed out cold. And she was, she said that the only thing that she could remember is hearing somebody in one of the other grades saying, Carol Reinhart died. So she thought she was dead. She was sure she was dead. And of course, when we had one of them.
Why did she faint?
Because of her fear. The fear of climbing over that fork handle halfway down in the silo chute.
Very frightening thing to be in that little round narrow chute. The inside of the silo was full of silage to the very top, and you had to climb in what, 2 foot space? A little round 2 foot space and hang on. And if you got stuck in there and you couldn't, you know, there was no way to make contact with anybody, you could stay there for a long time and nobody'd hear you, and it was dark and very frightening for a little girl, because she was maybe 10 years old.
I would imagine.
Most, maybe even 8. And so she managed it just fine, but thinking about it later, it's too scary.
One of the things that happened to the farm that has left its mark on Katie was riding the tractor down the hill. When we used to work on the hillsides with the tractor and handle loose hay, I was pitching the hay out of the windrow onto the tractor, and Katie was driving the tractor, and we just came to the steepest little pitch on the farm. Just over that little steep, it was not straight down, but just almost as severe as would carry sod. I did mow it, and it was mowed all the way down. It was sod. It wasn't a rock, but it was very, very steep, and then it leveled out at the bottom across the valley. And Katie was driving the tractor.
Followed by the hay wagon, followed by the hay loader.
And, yes, that's right, you were pulling a hay loader, weren't you?
Because there was a whole stream of things behind me.
Anyway, I said, just let it move ahead. Just let it move ahead, Katie. And in doing that, she put it in a neutral, which is the same thing that caused the terrible accident where a whole family were killed in Cuba City last week, where a truck driver put his truck into neutral instead of getting it into gear and utilizing the power of the engine to brake it. And it started to coast, and it started to coast down the hill, followed Katie and the tractor, followed by the wagon, followed by the hay loader, rattle, 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 bang, 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 all the way down there.
Faster and faster.
The only fortunate thing was that I had set the tractor out wide for cultivating, and it couldn't tip over sideways. My only fear was that Katie would try to jump off and the whole thing would go right over, and I kept yelling, write it down, don't jump, write it down, don't jump, and I was running down the hill trying to keep up with it as nearly as I could, but yelling and screaming at the top of my lungs, don't jump, write it down, and it just simply went down across the bottom.
I just kind of thought, well, shoot, it'll go to the bottom, then I'll go back up this other side. Sooner or later it'll stop, and it did, but I have fear of toboggans, sleds, bicycles on high heels, rug slides. I went with the boys to Devil's Lake, or to Wisconsin Dells. We paid our money. We went to climbed all those stairs to the top of the rug slide. This was about 3 years ago. I took one look at that rug slide. When you had no control, just get on that rug and go. And I said, sorry, fellas. And I turned right around, walked all the way back down the stairs and gave my rug back to the people. I think there's another thing that really stayed with me that is a story. I don't think I ever told you this.
You take one, side two. Katie, you had something in mind.
I was just thinking about how you have stories planted in your bones. I guess I told my students last week that people's bodies carry their history. And that I'd like to talk about a little bit, because I told my students how your broken arm and your crooked arm is the way you carry your history, and that all of us carry the history in our features. But the way I got to this idea, I was going to tell you, I was in Water Tower Place in Chicago last fall, And in one of these fancy stores, they had, of all things, stuffed chickens, realistic-looking chickens. And I was just standing there, and I suddenly was aware that here was, what's the word? You know, a live chicken that had been killed and stuffed, and I can't think, I want to say apothecary, that's not the word, you know what I mean. Taxidermy chicken.
Oh.
And I suddenly felt a whole physical reaction from my head to my toes of just absolute terror and shrinking. And in my bones is a reaction I didn't know was there based on when I used to gather the eggs and when that chicken jumped off the nest and chased me, or I thought it chased me. I'm sure it had no interest in me whatsoever. But at 7 years old, I'd been poking it with a stick to try and get the eggs out from under the chicken.
Oh, this was a setting hen. Oh, there's a difference between...
Okay. Well, this was a setting hen they had a water tower, too, with all these plastic eggs. Anyway, and the chicken jumped off the nest, and I started running, and I tripped over the log chain and broke my arm. And the chicken was long gone by the time I got up and dragged my arm into the house. But I didn't realize that that was planted in my bones until that day in Water Tower Place, when suddenly I was within 3 inches of what looked very much like a real setting hen, and I just cringed from head to toe. Really funny that your history is really buried in your body. Tell me the story again, see if I got it right, about your arm, because I tried to tell my students how that arm was a history of the medical care. And
oh, well, yes, it really was. I think I was five, and I got my first sled. And I went back where the picnic shelter is now, which then was a big slough. And probably not the first time that I did this. I ran down the hill, and I threw the sled on the ice, and I threw my body on top of it and went sliding across the ice just as far as inertia would take me. And after doing this a time or two, I came dashing down there, and I threw down the sled, and I threw down my body, and I missed the sled. And I made a one-point landing on my right elbow. And I can very well remember walking to the house with that elbow hanging so crooked, and saying, "Oh, I hurt my arm, but it isn't broke, Ma, it isn't broke, I know it isn't broke." Well, they took me up to Rockbridge to Dr. Hines' office. Dr. Hines was the old local country physician, and he stretched it out very gingerly and decided that this was something that was over and beyond his capacity to set. It was a bad elbow fracture, and they decided that I would have to go into Richland Center to another doctor. And going into Richland Center, the only x-ray, the first x-ray in Richland Center, was a dental x-ray in one of the dentist's office. And the consulting doctor said, "I bet you we could figure out some way of getting that elbow in the same position that they get mouths when they take the dental x-rays." So with a little experimentation, I was the first suspect, the first project of x-ray other than dental x-ray. And they decided that the arm was a little bit like a jigsaw puzzle that had been dropped. It had been broken in two places and also had disjointed itself. And they carefully manipulated the bones and eventually decided that that was about the best they could do with the circumstance, and put it in a right angle cast splint and hung it on my shoulder with a sling. And it was in there for several weeks before it healed without being manipulated at all. And when it was healed, it was fixed in a right angle position. And my mother decided that she didn't want me growing up
making a right turn.
Making a right turn with a right turn. I would be handicapped. And so she began manipulating it and coating it with warm coconut butter.
Every night I got that massage, and little by little by little, the arm began to straighten out. However, it always has a bend, and it has a way that I'm carrying it, which characterizes me from anybody else. If people are noticing this, if I just walk along with my arms hanging freely. Of course, it gave me a very good lever to lean on. I can say, now that's the reason that I write so poorly. This is the fact that when I was learning to write, other kids were learning to write, I could only get my arm into this right angle position. And by the time that I got my arm straightened out, it was already too late to learn to write very well. So I have a good point to lean on. I'm sure that this is...
Must have been genetic. I think I have the same problem. I was telling my class also the scar on my face is a way I carry my history. And I think I was just thinking all the broken bones I had were always part of my history as a child who was very lonely in the country, because every broken bone or wound I have has something to do with running to be with people. And that I was running to the Clarks. I must have been 10 years old at that time. And I was just always so eager to get over to the Clarks. They baked their own bread, and I can still smell the kitchen, the old cook stove they had where they baked the bread. And they used to kill their own chickens, and I can still remember being fascinated by all these chickens with no heads flopping around the yard. And I was running there to eagerly get over there and see all the Clark kids, and didn't realize they put up that new barbed wire fence and just really left my history on my lip, which I forget about, but a lot of people are aware of it. You have one that matches.
Mine is a bit of history, too. One time we were attempting to lay a second floor over the original floor in our dining room in real cold, cold weather, and taking a shortcut to taking down the stove and moving the stove out, we decided to lift up the stove leg by leg as the floor came to it, and put the floor right on under the stove without moving the stove. In the process, the stovepipe fell down, and the sharp edge gave me a cut and infiltrated a certain amount of soot into the cut. And so it left me with a mark very similar to Katie's mark. And on the same side, and mine is just the matter of the soot being embedded in the skin. Somebody's always apologetically saying, did you know that you have a little black mark there by your nose? Thinking that I did it with a
pencil.
And I say, yeah, I know. I well remember.
As far as that, I was also talking about how being bald, that my sons will probably be bald, and they will carry in their appearance the fact that they come from a line of people in which every other generation the males are bald. How far back can you trace that?
Well, of course, I can only see back two generations, and I can only see back to my grandfather, but my grandfather was very bald, and all of, as I remember him as a man of, well, my first memory would be to remember him as a man of 72, probably, when I was capable of remembering things, but he was bald, and I don't know, is every other generation, I think, it's quite a characteristic because
male, right?
Males are
nice to know.
carrying that along. I visualize my great grandfather. I have done everything that I can to try to find some relationship, something with my great grandfather and my great grandmother. And the only thing that I can really pin down with my great grandfather is the story that Neely, Mrs. Box, who was 104 when she passed away, and she told about great-grandpa sitting out on two legs of a chair at the old Hyatt House, which is just south of the courthouse in Richland Center, and sitting there on two legs of a chair in a sunny October afternoon, gazing uptown to see what's going on uptown, which was only a couple of blocks away, and talking to himself, and someone would call out, "Grandpa, who are you talking to?" "Well, for once in my life, I'm talking to an intelligent man." Well, this is the only picture that I have of Grandpa. But I visualize him. I don't know why I visualize him as looking like I do, except that my daughter Carol and I went to a carpenter, which was the family name, museum or farm in Rehoboth, Massachusetts. And across the road lived Windsor Carpenter, who was probably my 41st cousin, the family having come there in 1638, and he still owned the farm. And they called him over, and we had our pictures taken together, and we were here we were, heavy-shouldered, heavy-necked, round-headed, and bald, and the same height. Almost, we could have easily been brothers, or easily have been cousins, but we were so many generations apart. And I seemingly make that connection all the way back through, that this is the family characteristic. Not sure that it is true.
I'd really like to get captured. I've got to write this down to remember the whole story about Hal Driscoll's family, because one of the most dramatic stories I think of is the story of when, is it Aunt Lil, who came back to town after so many years. First of all, she was married to...
Well, to begin the story, my grandma's name was Nab, and her father had two families. Grandma was a part of the first family, and her mother must have been a very, very intelligent person, because Grandpa had a second family by a later woman, and that family was not particularly brilliant. So if Grandma must... My grandma's mother must have given to them a genetic strength, because there were four daughters, and they were all country school teachers and very intelligent people, and really, for the time and the opportunity in which they lived, were highly intellectual. However, the one that Katie refers to, Aunt Lil, eloped with a traveling man. I guess to continue to go repeat the story, she was at first married to a Mr. Driscoll, who lives in this area, and had one son. And then she eloped with a traveling...
He was old, wasn't he? Was he a lot older than she was?
I think probably. And she had one son, and she just simply took off with a traveling man and went off toward Minneapolis and lived up there all her life. And her son came to live with my grandpa and grandma, and was raised up more or less as their son, and a brother to my mother. And so Jess Driscoll was almost seemingly like my mother's brother. And then after many, many years, and after the traveling man had passed on and she was a widow up in Minneapolis, finally she came back and the sisters were reunited. And Jess, whom she had abandoned, looked after her for the remaining part of her lives. These things that we find happening today aren't particularly of our time. They are something that have been current through history.
They were very angry with her when
I'm sure they were. They were. It took a long time. I can remember the sisters talking between each other that Aunt Lil was pretty low on the totem pole because she had abandoned her son and had gone off this way. One of the things that I don't know whether I mentioned this before, Mark, talking about family history, that it's possible to encompass
the whole history of the United States in two conversations that I have heard about. I had a conversation with my grandfather, and my grandfather told me about having a conversation with his great-grandmother. And his great-grandmother, at the time that he remembered talking to her, was well over 100 years old and living out in the state of New York. And if I calculate his birth and the lives of the generations that reach back to this great-grandmother, she must have been born before the French and Indian War. So I can say, well, I had a visit with a man who had a visit with a woman who was born before the French and Indian War. And it's almost seemingly impossible that those are the logistics of the situation.
Do you remember what it was about, what she said?
Yes, I can. I can remember what Grandpa said about her. The river that they lived on in Chautauqua County, New York, which is right on the borderline just north of the Pennsylvania border. And there was a pond there, and logs were floated down to the mill, and the pond was covered with floating logs, and it must have been a small creek, and they must have floated the logs in at high water, but the kids would walk across the pond on the logs, and they would help grandmother across, who was 100 years old. So this part I can remember. Another thing that Grandpa...
I don't think I understood that clearly. Your grandfather talked about helping his great-grandmother cross.
Yes. Yes.
But did she talk at all about her childhood?
No, not that he repeated to me, at least. No, but I just would calculate by the... He was born in 38, and if she was 100 when he was 10... That would put her being born in 1738. And the French and Indian War wasn't until 1755. So she was born clear back at the very beginning of our history. How short a history we have. Have I talked to Mark about the tunnel?
Here?
Yes.
Yes, I...
We have that.
Sometimes I forget what I have on this year's tapes and past year's. Yeah, we did a whole thing on the rock.
And we did talk about Earl Sugden.
Mm. Not much on Earl Sugden. So I think
I'd get some. Okay. Well, Earl Sugden, of course, is one of my favorite characters.
While talking to Dale Muller, several times he said, now, you write down these questions. You ask Halsey about this. One was about a Sam and an Amy Guthrie.
Oh, they were good friends of mine.
Well... He said that he had been over playing here as a boy once, and up on the bluffs above the Pine River, they'd climbed down, and they'd gotten back into a cave area, and there were skeletons of people back in there. And that he had mentioned it to her, I guess, and she said, it's okay, just don't talk about it. I'll tell him to go out and take care of it. And he said, I always wondered who those were skeletons of. And he said, many years later, he'd come back here, gone and tried to find that ledge, but it seemed to have broken off and he couldn't get back in.
Well, this brings up something that I haven't heard. Sam and Amy Guthrie were old friends of ours. Sam was the moving light of the International Order of Odd Fellows here in Richland, in Rockbridge, and the Odd Fellows always had such big feeds about 11 o'clock at night that over a period of a couple of years, three of them died in their sleep from heart trouble, from overeating the night before. And I guess it was sort of depopulated the organization and it finally dropped down. But this particular story, I don't know. I do know the story of the hidden cachet of bullion or silver that is supposed to be hidden under the edges of the rock. And when the Blackhawk people came through here, the story was that they were chased by the militia and they left, buried under an edge of the rock near the river, and then they drew the picture, just marked in with their stone axe, the picture of a serpent above the point where they buried this bullion. And when I was a little boy, an Indian came to Rockbridge, and he inquired all up and down if anybody had ever seen a place along the rock where there was a serpent chiseled into the edge of the rock. And he told the story of this silver being buried there. And about 2 or 3 years ago, a man came down from Hub City, and he said, "Did you ever hear this legend about silver being buried under the rock?" And I said, "It's sure been a long time. It was when I was a little boy that I heard it." And he said, "An Indian was up to Hub City today who said his grandfather had been told by his grandfather that he was with Black Hawk and that they had buried this silver." And I just always laughed and said, "Oh, those Indians didn't have silver enough to fill a tooth. They had no silver." But in my studies of Black Hawk, I found that they did intercept a military train down in the Gratiot area, and they had about 400 pieces of silver that had been intended to pay off the militia. So that it is entirely possible that there, that bit of silver is buried under the edges of the rock here in this area. So that's one of the legends that might persist, and it has good backing.
I always thought of that there's a story of some children that were killed under one of the rocks.
This valley had a series of tragedies in one particular year. This valley had a series of tragedies one particular year. On our farm, up above our house, a little girl and her brother were chasing a rabbit, and they chased it under the edges of the rock. And they decided to dig it out, and they got some sticks, and they started digging and digging and digging, and the rabbit was back in the hole. And the little girl was under trying to reach the rabbit or dig, and the rock tipped over and crushed her head. And her father, who was clear across the valley sawing wood, heard the commotion, and he ran across the valley and up the hill to where this little girl was pinned, and was able to lift that rock enough so that the brother could pull her out. And that rock lay on the farm there for many, many years, and I'm sure that four men couldn't have lifted the rock. He did it. This was one tragedy that happened. Another tragedy that happened only about 2 miles farther, about the same year, a man and his wife went to the barn to milk and left their three children in the house. And when they went to the barn door, the house was all on fire, and the three children were burning up. And as a little boy, I can remember coming out into the backyard, looking up the valley, and hearing and seeing the smoke. And then a man's voice just screaming, "Oh my God, my babies! Oh my God, my babies! Oh my God, my babies!" And three of those children did burn up at that time. And then on up the road about 2 miles farther, and the same year, some kids were playing under the edge of an old kind of a root cellar in soft sandstone, and they were playing and digging in the rock, and the rock caved in, and I think it was three children that were killed there under that. So within the space of a year and a half, there were 7 deaths of children within about a 3-mile area here.
You do have, I hope, recorded the story of the Wall family somewhere.
I think we did.
Yeah,
we talked about.
The other question Daniel asked was about Bud Hissy. He said Bud was his granddad's brother-in-law, something like that.
He's Bloom City.
He's from Bloom City? I see. I should ask if you all knew him over here.
I didn't know him.
He used to come to my dad's store.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he lived north of Bloom City, in West Lyman.
I see. So you're going to talk about Earl Sutherland.
Oh, yes. Earl, you know, there are gifted people who defy the genetic process sometimes. There are people who have gifts that are all out of proportion to their background. And Earl Sugden was certainly one of these people, out of a family of average intelligence and not a great particular interest in things of greater study, came Earl Sugden. He started to school when he was in the about 6 years old, in the first grade, and he went to school that day and somebody made fun of him. And they were very backward and bashful, and he ran home and wouldn't go back to school until he was in the eighth grade, until the time that he should have been in the eighth grade. When he did go back to school, he had learned mathematics, and he had learned grammar, and he had learned to write, and he had learned geography, and all these things he had taught himself. He learned the English language by getting a dictionary, studying a dictionary. Many of the things that he learned by reading the Sears and Roebuck catalog. But he was totally self-educated, and he went, having gone only the one day in the first grade and about 6 weeks in the eighth grade, he managed to graduate from the eighth grade and then went into the county teacher's college and went to the county teacher's college a year and graduated there as being one of the most intelligent of the class. A little irrational and orthodox, I guess, but very much very intelligent. And then he taught in the rural schools for 16 years, and he was an innovative teacher, one of those teachers who would say, well, it's just too nice to be cooped up in school today. What say, kids, we all go out on the hill today? And so out on the hill they would go, and they'd study biology, and they'd study geology, and they would study botany, and everything that would be in connection with the universe and with nature, and probably a greater variety than any group of other children were getting in Richland County. One of his students, Lucille Thompson, has said to me that I never see a beautiful flower but what I think Earl Sugden taught me to love the flowers. And I never look at the stars at night but what I think, well, Earl Sugden taught me to know the stars. And many people, especially my own thinking, has been so influenced by Earl Sugden and his quest for knowledge. A total reader and a man photographic mind, who could simply sit down and read a book and give a logical, comprehensive summary of it when he got through. The kind of memory that very few people have. I don't know if it was just one of the quirks of nature, the coincidences, but he all through his life, he combed his hair like Einstein. It stood on end. Being attractive and being very looking like the run-of-the-mill population wasn't his greatest asset. And one of